Hi, I'm your host, Mark Anielski, on the Economy of Wellbeing podcast. My next guest is Dennis Cuckoo. Dennis is a good friend, an engineer, a father of teenage children, a husband, an entrepreneur, and a speaker who is passionate about self-improvement, productivity, mental health, and sustainable development. For those of you who live in Edmonton, Dennis is the co-creator of the Mosaic Center, the first net zero commercial energy building built in Alberta a few years ago. Dennis and his former wife Christy conceived and built this remarkable structure as a model for what I would call well-being by design. Some of you living in Edmonton might be familiar with the Workshop Eatery, which is one of Edmonton's favorite restaurants, which has its home in the Mosaic Center. Dennis co-founded the former Mosaic family of companies, a knowledge worker cooperative or collective, which was designed to effect positive social change through business. He and his former partner dreamed of and manifested the Mosaic Center for Conscious Community and Commerce, and this building was completed in the spring of 2015. The Mosaic Center is in the deep southern district of Edmonton and would become the crown jewel of sustainable building in Edmonton, becoming the first net zero energy commercial office building in Alberta, an example of Alberta's oil and gas abundance, igniting innovative, sustainable projects. As a visionary entrepreneur, Dennis operates on the manifesto that normal is broken and that capitalism need not come at the expense of human values, environmental sustainability, or personal happiness. Dennis is an animated and stimulating communicator with a zeal for fun, awesomeness, and abolishment of the status quo. Dennis is a mechanical engineer by training with expertise in drilling and rig design. He served as acting president of Oil Country Engineering, which designed and built drilling rigs until the price of oil collapsed beginning in 2015. With the tough love of that market collapse beginning to bite hard in 2016, Dennis knew the writing was on the wall. When large rig orders were canceled, he sadly had to let go of his beloved Mosaic Center and move on to other ventures. He is compassionate by nature with a heart for altruism. Dennis believes an altruistic approach to business will help society adapt to a rapidly changing world. He understands that in this time of rapid change and disruption, our leaders are being called upon to develop healthy workplaces, schools, family units, and governments capable of thriving, not just surviving. He says there needs to be a humanistic approach to business. If we're going to subscribe to this idea of capitalism, we don't have to rape and pillage along the way. We can still have free enterprise, and we can still have what our planet needs. Dennis and I, like many of my guests, have an interesting story. Story of friendship and relationships, and also ongoing discussions about how we can develop new structures and businesses based on well-being that forms the heart of a new economy. Enjoy this conversation with Dennis Cuckoo. So Dennis Cuckoo, welcome to the Economy of Wellbeing podcast. I think you're my 80th guest. You're a the number of harmony. Wow, 80. I never thought about it until this moment.
So pressure's on right now. I guess we're going down the harmony path today, hey?
The harmony path, and you know, to infinity and beyond. That's what 8 represents, right?
Right on.
You turned it sideways.
Thanks for getting me in and recording me here instead of just being in your backyard talking about things. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Mark.
So Dennis, born in Coal Lake, had an interesting young life growing up in Alberta, engineer by training, oil country, building oil rigs until oil prices collapsed yet again. Amazing, you and your former wife, Christy, building, dreaming about the Mosaic Center. That itself, that's how I got to know you before you actually built that thing, but you had a dream, you manifested, you're just an intuitive business guy, an entrepreneur. Albertan, just a fine guy, and we've had some amazing conversation with our little group that you call us the 10 real men, which kind of irritates some women, but we try to be real men. And tell us about your story so far, and
you just give us the story. He was like, I thought we're done.
I just gave you a high level.
I thought we're good there.
None of this is on Wikipedia, by the way, because you have no profile at Wikipedia, I noticed. So doesn't matter.
It's kind of by design. Oh, man, story. Hey, like, you know, I don't like to talk about myself like that. Well, I wasn't actually born in Cold Lake, so I'll start with a correction. I was born in Edmonton and came back to Edmonton after, spending some years up in the north. Story. You touched on the Mosaic Center. You know, that was a pretty major project here in Edmonton. Just love doing projects. I guess if you stitched all that together, maybe I'll give the executive summary instead of getting into all the details for everybody listening. I get really excited about taking on projects that everybody says can't be done. You know, I had somebody say once that I had Marty McFly syndrome. You know, if you remember from Back to the Future, where Marty McFly, you know, Biff and Marty McFly have this thing in each of the three Back to the Futures where he calls him chicken. And he's like, what'd you call me? And then it goats him into whatever the challenge is at the time. And, you know, the Mosaic Center, arguably the world's furthest north net zero office building here in Edmonton, 30,000 square feet. I had quite a few people tell me that it couldn't be done. So I at the end of the day, I think, you know, the dream aside and, you know, the amazing project team, all local here in Edmonton, aside from that, I think it was just because I have this undaunting fear of failure. I just don't want to, I don't want anybody to say, hey, look at that guy. That's that guy that crashed and burned. So I guess maybe just that's my Eastern European roots coming out in me there. So yeah, man, the story, like, what is the story? Hey, it's always fishtailing. It's who knows what's coming next. Who knows if even what we're recalling of the past is even really real anymore. You know, you tell the story so many times, they start to change.
I think my story is in being introduced to you by my neighbor, Stephanie Carter, who started Eco Ammo several years ago. And she said, you gotta meet Dennis and Christy from Oil Country. I'm like, Oil Country? I wouldn't work for an oil company. Like, and I think they'd really like your ideas on well-being. And so I remember us meeting and then my colleague and I pitching you, and I won't tell the whole story, but I just remember you closing your laptop and saying, I don't understand what you guys are pitching me at all. I don't understand. Like, we're a highly functional, fun loving team already. And why do we need well-being? But then you and I became friends, and we started thinking about what if the Mosaic Center was designed not just as a super engineered, efficient building, but it actually, because of the windows and sunlight coming in, it actually shaped the consciousness of people who worked in that space, that people actually felt emotionally an increase in well-being when they came to work. Or they left Friday going, you know, my work was awesome this week. I have great clients. I love the sunshine. I love sitting on those stairs. I might like the coffee, the filtered water, but there's something about this space that by design, you created a place where well-being can be felt.
I know what you're doing here. You do this every time. You loser. You didn't get all the data. Like, you quantify this every time you bring this up. How do you even quantify that, right? Like, what you use the big C word, consciousness, and you know, most of us don't even really fully understand what that is. It's like, you got such a overtone of ambiguity to it. But at the end of the day, like that project, and you know, when you came in and you experienced it for the first time, all I wanted was a place where people could feel like a kid again. You know, if you like, I don't have young kids anymore, but at the time my kids were pretty young, and I running businesses and just being trapped in this, whatever life, the four-letter word of life, I would watch my kids play and be like, man, like what it'd be like to feel that again, you know? And when we were doing the design shreds for the building, my youngest daughter, Lauren, would have been four or five. And we asked her, like, she was at the table with the architects, and we asked her to draw what she thought the building should look like, or what it would like to be in the building. And she drew this amazing picture. I wish I could share it with everybody. But at every color, she took a little bit of every color out. She drew circles and rectangles and squares and blobs and streamers and rainbows. And she showed it to the architect. And I remember Vedran at Manaska Isaac, he picked that up and he goes, that's exactly what we have to build. It's important that that's what goes on that street corner.
Wow.
That became actually the design intent for the building, is when, you know, a 65-year-old banker or a 32-year-old accountant walks into that building, that they feel that again. And, you know, it's a bit audacious to say this, but to test the limits with architecture, with a space instead of just a building, and how that can help people fall in love with life again. If you can engineer a community of people, like you said, that consciousness where people are coming in and there's an explicit intent that the building is offering to the people that come and enjoy it every day, then what could really happen in a space like that? You know, obviously beautiful natural light, you know, powered by the sun, those are attributes, but what about the energy behind it? And that's why it was really important that everybody was local. They understood that the stakeholders were all here in the city of Edmonton. And I think the only thing that we couldn't quite get our head wrapped around and get done in Edmonton was the windows. They came from Calgary. So 100.0% executed project in Alberta. So
wow.
Everybody said, oh, you can't do that, you're crazy. And I accept that label. We need more crazy in the world. It's not like shoot them up kind of crazy, but yeah.
Well, I often say consciousness, it sounds like a big word, but it just means awareness. And the fact that you were sensitized to Lauren, your five-year-old's vision of play, is something I don't think, if I heard it before, I don't remember. But I think it's such a beautiful reflection on how is it that as adults we've suspended this playfulness that we experience as children, this sense of awe and wonder and joy. And then we spend the rest of our lives trying to find that again. And here you've built a space where people can remember what it's like to run around, jump on those stairs, like sit in a, and then think, gosh, this is like Greece, this is some Socratic dialogue space, but it's actually looks really fun to jump down those wooden stairs. And
the answer to your question is in the question. Like you said, how is it, making this differentiation between Mark Anielski, the economist, and little Mark cruising around on his bike or throwing rocks, skipping rocks. There is, like, tell me the point where one shifted to the other.
But it's fun that, you know, it's interesting that I was like, the secret to no gray hair is just laughing and feeling like a kid every day.
Huh. Yeah, that's part of another secret to no gray hair is just not talking. You know, it's like, oh, it's just gray hair. It's just
gray.
Like, oh, well, I'm getting older. I understand gray hair is figurative.
Well, genetically, I'm blessed with that because my grandma lived to 95, and I swear she had maybe half of her hair was gray. And
ridiculous. Yeah, it's just, it goes deeper than the play though. It's like, you know, like the issues in our world are so complex now, and like, as a species or, you know, our ecosystem, like we're entering into this period of, it's called VUCA. I love that acronym: volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. Mm. And when you look into a child, like, you know, around six, that changes, but you know, you look into a 4 or 5-year-old child's eyes, they don't see that. They just see the world for what it is. They haven't been patterned yet. You know, those beautiful creatures haven't got that dose of Facebook or Instagram or whatever the hell that finishes us off. But, you know, and that's it. Like what that, you know, call it spark or whatever is in that child. So I think I shared with you once the story, Parker, my middle guy, he was seven. We had taken a family trip to Costa Rica. And we're trying to figure out what we wanted to do. You know, as you mentioned, my ex-wife, Christy, things weren't great on the home front. The priorities were misaligned or whatever, but we had chosen to detox life. That's what we called it. So we took a year, we moved around with the kids a bit. You know, she had gone and did some traveling. I'd done some traveling, and we sort of came to this place where we wanted to do a family trip, and we love Costa Rica. We traveled there a few times. So anyway, we're in Nosara, a little surfing community, and Parker and I were doing our daily session. It was a little bit later, just based on, you know, the tide charts or whatever. And sun was still high, and we're walking back, and like, I'll never forget this day. We always stopped at this little kind of taco shop, like whatever. He loved the fries there and whatever, you get like this root beer kind of thing. And you know, we were chatting, and he had overheard Christy and I talking about, you know, maybe moving to Costa Rica and, you know, what that would be like. And so he asked me the question, like, you know, so, you know, am I going to speak Spanish or what, how's that going to go? He's seven, right? He doesn't get, yeah. Doesn't get it. So, no, they've got English schools here. Like, you'll learn Spanish, and you're like, oh yeah, yeah. Okay. I get that. And he asked me a bunch more questions, and then he looked at me, and you know, I have a photo of him, because his eyes were sort of a darker bluish color. They were transitioning from blue to, he's got kind of like hazel colored eyes, but they were this bright, bright greenish blue. And he looked at me and he said, but what are you going to do? I remember thinking, you know, like, what do you mean? What am I going to do? He's like, well, what are you going to do? Like, we're going to live in like all these other things that you are doing. You know, you're not a human being, Dad. You're a human being. Like, oh, I don't know. Like, you know, I just give him some sort of, you know, buzz off answer. Like, you know, just open a surf shop or I don't know, whatever. Just kind of hang out. And he goes, oh yeah, no, of course. Yeah. You can just do something like that, of course. And I couldn't get that out of my mind. I just couldn't, like, what are you going to do? And, you know, at the time I was blessed to, you know, call it hit my number or whatever. You know, things were really good. I guess be a little bit cheeky here. I was enjoying the byproduct of colonialism as a white male in North America. Let's just be really honest what it was. So I didn't really need anything else. So I couldn't, like, every time I sat on my meditation cushion, every time I rolled up my yoga mat, there was that sound of, what are you going to do? So ultimately, we came back to Edmonton, and that's what kicked off the project. Wasn't really sure that we were going to do the building. We were going to kind of cash in the chips, and, you know, I call it now running away or, you know, escaping. But I realized that would have been the high road. The real work needs to be done, you know, at home, to hang out on the beach and, you know, surf. And, you know, those are fun things to do. But I, you know, as a 35 year old male, it didn't seem right. So we came back and poured all of the wealth and time into that project, not because it was the building and it was an asset, but just to show that there was a better way. And, you know, when people visit that building and they really feel it and they seek to understand what it's about, it makes change.
Wow.
So that's the real backstory on how the most, so I owe it actually to Parker, had he not hit me with that piece of, you know, I was almost
And both your children, right? I mean, to think that both our children are reminding us, right? That difference between doing and being, right? That's profound. And can you talk about, you know, and then, you know, we had the oil price crash, and it's almost like you had a prescient or prophetic vision. I don't know. I'm not going to call you a prophet, but you're sort of what I consider a gift of your intuition, gut feel, call it. It's almost like you saw this coming. You saw the end of the latest oil wave and boom. And then suddenly there were no demands for rigs anymore. And you literally had to.
Mark, I would flip that question around on you. You're the economist. Isn't it your kind that engineers this up and down? You know?
I think they're, you know, some people say, oh, there's waves, there's patterns, there's Kondraty of waves, like there's patterns of seven and eight. And if you look back long enough, you see these patterns. So yes. It's not like you were super clairvoyant but I think you saw the consequences, you saw what would happen. And you decided as a business person also to leave that stage, and you're an entrepreneur. Yeah. You're guided by intuition, I think, if I could put it that way.
I know this is going out on the airwaves, so we're going to get into some territory here. But you know, if you don't share your story, what the hell, you die with it. you know, there wasn't as much that was you know, clairvoyant in that experience. We had our, you know, a huge contract canceled, and we'd never had a contract canceled before. And these are $1 million projects, and with, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 surrender fees on it. And, you know, guy just phoned me up. I was like, yeah, you're going to have to just keep the money. This is a vice president who had a $20,000 spending limit just reduced to $500 overnight. So it was
like that. So
there was a definite shift. And, you know, I'm also sensitive to the audience out there. Like, you don't just reach out and turn on the oil patch in Alberta after you shut it down. Like, we're an aged oil field. Let's just call it that. Like,
right.
If you look at the reality of it, it is much cheaper, much more economically advantageous to exploit developing countries for their natural resources than to have safety plans and safety policies and be paying welders $125 an hour and, you know, just, you know, rig hands, you know, these large wages, when you can go and people are working for a bowl of beans and rice in some of these other countries. So the writing was on the wall. It wasn't as prophetic as, you know, maybe romanticized story would be. Like, shit, this is coming to an end. This is the end. The brakes are on. And my decision to leave the Mosaic family was, you know, Christy and I had just separated, and it just there wasn't really a need for what I could offer the organization, and I wanted to go this way, and a good chunk of the organization wanted to go that way, and I really did subscribe to the concepts of servant leadership. That's Greenfield's work, and that we had a council. There were seven of us, and I was kind of in the middle. There was operations council. There was the, you know, sort of the administrative or the architecture of the organization. And it's like, you know, my salary, my desire to go this way was just going to destroy the company. So that's ultimately why I left. And that was not an easy choice. Mm. It was the hardest part of that, because I love parties. I love everybody celebrating for whatever reason. I just like people getting together, which is something we're starting to forget now.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But I said, no fanfare. It's just time to head on. So like an old dairy cow, I just walked out into the pasture and took a bullet.
Took yourself out. Yeah. So my next burning question, I know you played hockey, and we all, at least I grew up with Gretzky living actually literally down the street from me. And Gretzky used to, what was this, the famous line? I skate to where the puck is going to be. And where's the puck for you right now? Where are you skating to?
Oh man, I love my job so much. Like, I, you know, every year I look back, I'm like, oh, that was kind of a crappy file or a crappy client. I just love it. I'm blessed. I don't know what I'm going to do from day to day. So I guess I'm just kind of like, I work on special projects, and there's just so much happening in the world, so much change happening, and so many people trying to just digest what, you know, we just pumped the brakes on our old paradigm of reality with COVID-19, like massive disruption. So the entire way we work and live and interact with levels of government and, you know, those guys up there, that's all being rewritten right now. And there's a lot of work to do there. So I do like that. So yeah, I kind of working from special projects, but if I say it next, then I'm going to have to do it. You know, I know what you're trying to get me to say. We sat at your kitchen table. How many years when did you start writing your second book?
2017, I think. Or maybe 2016, we sat down and you put that napkin on my
front. I shit the bed. We made a deal that we were both going to write so many words by a certain point. And I was like, you know what, Mark, I failed. You crushed me. You actually printed your There's a copy of the book and I, in, you know, in my house, I haven't even got to the halfway mark on my book, but I feel like that is something, we talked about being called to do. If there's something higher kind of flowing through the fingertips, it's there's definitely a call to write. Less about, you know, maybe the things you're asking me about, like the projects, but more about, you know, I've always been very interested in this idea of when does a boy become a man? It even sort of happened in that conversation earlier. Like, what is that? I mean, I never had that point. You know, being raised in Cold Lake, you get some keys to a truck and you're like, oh, am I a man now? You know, you're allowed into the bar. Like, how about now? You know, your first naked woman, you're like, whoa, this has to be it now. Then like all of these things. And it's like, but I just never really knew. So I've been, exploring this idea and also, you know, what it means to be a man tomorrow. Mm. With everything changing and, you know, especially the idea of a man changing over the last, let's just say 20 or 30 years. It's very confusing, especially for some of us that might be in that sort of 40 to 55 range when that narrative changed while after our very, classically raised fathers were like, nope, this is a woman's job. And this is, you know, and then everything's changing and getting tore apart. So
right,
what are the dads of today sharing with their sons? And
so
even right now, Go ahead. I can round.
Now here's a deep question then. Fast forward, 7-year-old Parker on the beach, you know, dreaming about mojitos and the surf shop and living forever, you know, happy ever after, like Disney. Yeah. And now your son at what, 16? And what does a father of a teenage boy tell the son during this crazy pandemic situation? How do you engender hope? That reflection on doing versus being. What do you say to Parker this afternoon?
This conversation?
No, this is kind of like a Jordan Peterson meets. I don't know who he meets, but
man, it's just so tough. These poor kids right now. You know, Mark, what were you doing when you were 16? Like,
I was listening to the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac. I was dreaming about kissing a girl, you know.
You're dreaming of boobs and you're figuring out where you're where you're supposed to line up in the world, where your pecking order is, and just none of that is there. And there's this really like sort of almost like it's like putting on a wool sweater with no undershirt on. Like it's really abrasive for these kids in there.
Mm.
Trying to do the right thing, but they want to be social and connect, and I just think the long-term effect of what's happening with our young people right now, like I don't even know how you try to even quantify that. Like I'm not a, you know, social scientist, but, you know, I've read Freakonomics and I know what happens when, you know, things like this happen, what the long-term effects are. And I just like the generation that's going to have to pull this thing out of the fire, you know, call it the Phoenix generation. And I have a visual where it's like my kid, all these sort of like early teenagers right now are like on the airplane stick, just pulling it up. And like, it's like wheels are clipping the tops of the trees. Like, come on, you know, just
the shuttering, just like, the whole fuselage is shuttering and
screws are coming out of the thing. Like, you know, that's just such an amazing visual or metaphor for what's going on in the world right now. And here we are, we're bootstrapping them with this, just this period of unrest, unknowing, uncertainty, and, you know, and like probably I'm going to maybe show a bit of my colors here. The worst of all, patterning this sort of acquiescence to what's happening in the world, as opposed to standing up. Like we need this next generation to say, you know what? Hey, old balls, that's not okay anymore. You can't do that. Like, it's just really challenging to see.
I think that's the reflection I'd love to explore here is, you know, as an economist, economics is based on this, I call it the lie of scarcity. When in truth, as we know from natural systems and nature, the truth is abundance. And so we, you know, it's funny that we're living in this kind of imposed, maybe self-isolation, as if as if the whole world is in a monastery right now, forced to go deep into your own rabbit hole of your own being, right? And that's hard. That's hard to be in that place. I mean, ask anyone who's living in a monastery or convent. It's not easy. You think, oh yeah, I just make beer and meat and cheese all day, you know, and I'm loving to my fellow cellmate there. No, it's not that easy. Right. And yet we have this opportunity, and why I get excited, we have our opportunity to manifest something more compelling and more spectacular than this artificial scarcity model, in which money is the only kind of psychopathic, sociopathic motivator, when that's a big lie. The truth is abundance, right? And mm-hmm. as an economist, it drives me crazy. Yesterday, we had an 800-page budget come down from Chrystia Freeland. And there's no even celebration of what's happening in Canada in terms of how are people feeling about their life? Like, why do they love where they live? Why do you like or not like your job? What has COVID done to your relationship with your household, right? The emotion questions, never asked. All these numbers, right? And I'm a bean counter. So to me, there's that opportunity for Parker and others to go, you know what? We can literally manifest. We can dream up anything. You dreamed up the Mosaic Center. You know, I think there's just so much promise in our the energy of our youth. And we have a responsibility, I think, as those who may have been the architects of this, you know, I won't say worse system, because everything is a teacher, but what are we gonna take away? Like in 5 years, when we look back, it's like, look what happened. Everyone will know this was a clear marker in history. And Parker will look back when he's 21 and go,
Communicate that to a 16-year-old that's living in a world where everything's been commodified, you know, like the sacred and the spiritual has been removed from everything and doesn't really appear on any interface, especially the one that's in their hand, you know, 8 hours a day. You know, that's the real challenge is, and that's what this book is about. You know, I'm calling it Morrow's Men.
You know, Morrow's Men. Oh, Morrow's title. Men. I like that.
Yeah, well, it is. It's like we're talking. We seem to have fallen into this groove, and that's what we're chatting about. And it's there's nothing to endorse. Like, this isn't shameless at all. Like, I'm actually feeling quite a tremendous amount of it's sort of half exploring where we've come from and how we've got to this narrative of what a man is. And in the second half, I call it the manual. And if somebody's out there and they've written this before, like, I'm not trying to rip anything off. I just haven't done that level of exploration. But imagine if you're 12 to 16, boners are just going off like crazy. Imagine if you actually had the operating manual for your body. We don't teach that in school. You know, we pump the kids into this institutional education system, and we're, you know, if Jason Kenney has his way, we're going to learn about God knows what kind of crazy, you know, curriculum.
Well, we'll only maybe learn about his grandfather, but what about your grandfather, Dennis?
He was a hell of a jazz musician, I guess, right?
Right. And what about your grandfather, my grandfather? Like, how come, why aren't they in the curriculum? Like, everyone should be in the curriculum.
Anyway, I don't want to touch that one right now. On the episode two, right? But yeah, like, what, imagine if the boys of today actually understood what their screens do into them, you know, what that boner means, what the vagus nerve is doing, you know, what that sort of stimulus response, how to cultivate compassion. That's what our planet needs. That's what the men of tomorrow need to do. We need to move into this, I don't know, like this epoch of basically like relentless compassion, knowing that, Mark, if I was you and I was raised by your parents and I had that like full ancestral lineage, I would be doing the exact same fucking thing you're doing right now. I would have no choice. That's it. Yeah. That there is no other way. And if we could approach our relationships, our whatever, our economic, political, social issues with that level of compassion, then we start to heal some things.
Wow.
That's audacious. I don't know if I'll be able to pull that off in this book, but I think, I understand the men. I had those own challenges with my own father, and You know, we
all do, right? We all have father issues, good and bad.
Yeah, good. Yeah, issues are they're an invitation to make change or to move through and do some healing of you know what's behind us next, kind of a thing. And yeah, man. So it's big stuff, and I think that's why it's been such a challenge. And you know, I didn't really get into it. We all have this. We all have this thing where we'll start to bring into our life these, I call it mental masturbation, where we'll just start bringing these things in to plug the holes or the space that, you know, we should really be doing what the divine is asking us to do. And I just, the COVID's been pretty hard for me to stay focused. There's just a lot going on and, you know, trying to make sense of what's really going on in the world. And, you know, the conflicting stories, the upheaval of things. And, you know, and I admittedly have a fairly significant distrust for the institution, you know, courtesy of September 11th, but
yeah, really. It's not hard to be cynical or believe that there's some, like it's in the Matrix, there's maybe some architect of the universe that controlling us as puppets. But then I think that's giving them too much credit. Like, no, we are sovereign individuals here to manifest our dream, the reason we were born as a Crise, born into a prayer. And I think that raises the question. I know this is a hard question. You can totally discount it and
you can pass. Oh, you didn't tell me I can get a pass. Maybe I'll use it here.
Well, one of the questions I asked of Leah Mattinson, who is on the show a few sessions ago, and she's from Edmonton. She's a life coach. And I said, so let's play this game, Leah. You know, we just got elected and we're the whatever party, doesn't matter what party you are. And you're the health minister. What kind of, and you got 50% of the budget. What would you do? What would you be tabling today if today was budget day? And Dennis, if you were if you were the head of Treasury Board right now for Alberta, and you've been part of like this oil economy has been with us since Peter Lougheed stepped on the stage in 1972, right? And that's very interesting when you talk to the old guys, you know, that were there, Peter's kitchen table, right? And they talk about how they said, it wasn't that they would dismiss their so-cred grandparents who were in power for 40 years. Say, they said, now's our time. This is our generation. And we've had this oil economy for 40 plus years and benefited enormously from the wealth. And it's kind of corrupted us in a way. It's made us feel entitled and smug. And COVID's like stopped us in our tracks, not just Alberta, but everywhere. And so what, and we just saw this budget yesterday federally. And they've just sold a $500 billion worth of paper called bonds. And there's no discussion about who bought it or who we owe it to, or it's like, no, fine. You'll be fine. You'll get your SERB checks landing in your bank account.
Star Wars, hey, where Obi-Wan goes, there are no droids here.
There's no, it's like,
there are no future problems here.
And like, wait a minute, as a economist, helicopter money just appeared in your bank account. You just had a few clicks of the mouse and you got 2,000 in your bank account.
God.
And so I guess the question is,
what do I do?
If we were the leaders of this province right now, it's not just crazy hypothetical, because I've been advising the Green Party leader, young leader, who's a firefighter. And I said, your most iconic character in our economy, like firefighters, who doesn't trust a firefighter? How could you not be able to sell happiness as a firefighter for this province?
All right. Well, let's use the firefighters.
Right, because I know you're working on something related to fire.
Yeah. My grandfather was a member of parliament, and that wow. ended when Kim Campbell made her gigantic blunder. So he was a Mulroney era member of parliament. So I do have some, and my grandmother.
Wow. Which riding? Like Coal Lake?
Sturgeon. So just north of.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
He was a real beauty and a real, real awesome like figurehead in the community. And my grandmother, she died about 5 years after he did. And every time I'd come in and she was fine, she'd go, "Mon beau Denis," she'd look at me and she'd grab my face. just like your grandfather. When are you going to go into politics?
Oh no,
Grandma, I'm just not sure. I think maybe I'm that underground version of politics. I'm going to get me love and disruption. Not on the commons floor. I'm going to do it. Do it in the back streets and on podcasts, I guess. Okay, look, man, I'm gonna break it down for you. I have thought about this and I've journaled about it because, you know, if you want to be the change, you have to vote with your dollars and vote with your mouth. And when we have these conversations, we're putting energy out into the world. So I gotta think it's education. And I don't mean in a classical sense. We are living in a world right now that, like, it's just the you can't unthatch our critical issues from each other. Like we just, everything is very, very complex. You cannot, you know, take economic issues, like, you know, capitalism is failing. You can't unthatch that at the end of the day from child soldiers in Asia. Like, it's just, it's all connected. They're all links in the chain. And we have to recognize that we're part of that. We're not above it up here, like this sort of supreme orchestrator of it all. So, you know, underneath what I'm trying to say is sort of, yes, it's a spiritual revolution of sorts, but at the more concrete level, at the leading edge of this revolution of sorts, we have to take a head-on run at the paradigms that are just not going to serve a hyper-globalized world moving forward. The world's shrinking. It's just not going to. So I think, you know, if you look at that taxonomy, I think you would want to have get people that are maybe don't have an understanding of what each government's trying to actually really move through. And, you know, it's not, you know, I'm an elephant or I'm a liberal or what, that doesn't work anymore, where you need one to have the other. So that the polarization and this sort of duality, you need both actually feed each other. You know, it's like, what's a goody goody two shoes going to be if there isn't anybody out, you know, stealing cars or, you know, robbing liquor stores, you know? So we need that. We live in a dualistic world. So I think just bringing that to the forefront and saying, hey, you know, here's what these people want. Here's what these people want. Having that conversation. So I would, and we hire the firefighters, right? Everybody trusts the firefighter to do that. Educate. No, that was stupid.
No, we put out, you know, there is that metaphor. We're constantly trying to put out fires, you know, and the house is on fire. I think Greta Thunberg said that. And you're working on some interesting fire prevention technologies. And I think you've touched something fascinating too, is, of course, you know, we started off with, this show is sponsored by the number 8. If you turn it on its side, it looks like infinity. And it's a constant flow of relationship through that sacred spiral of constant balance and rebalance, yin and yang. So you really touched on some deep stuff here.
Well, our brains try to go to one problem. Like, okay, we have this insane discontinuity of wealth from the supreme willy wealth to the people that are struggling to just survive. That's not okay. I mean, it's getting worse, and we're not gonna take a run at Bill Gates gobbling up all the land like a modern colonialist, but, you know, like, shit like that can't happen if we're gonna make it. I also believe in my heart that there's no mistakes. There's one version of reality. So it's not a question of right or wrong. It's happening, and are we okay with it? Do we want to make change? Because we still have agency over that. But, you know, with whatever 8 billion people, and there's a, you know, essentially 80 of them running the show, it's a lot harder to have agency over that. So, you know, like, so my tagline, put it on your t-shirt, Mark, is, you know, if we fall in love with life again, and that's like to say to, like, reconnect with the true self, the true essence of who we are, not this controller of nature, but that we're a link in everything, we play a part of it, then our true essence, our true beauty, then our social, economic, political, all those issues will start to reconcile themselves. I just, I don't know. I'm not a trained economist. I'm not a politician, but I'm a human. And that just, like, my heart kind of vibrates a bit when I say that. So that feels like the right answer. And, you know, I do my best to try and, you know, emulate that every day. I don't shit rainbows. So, you know, I'm not perfect.
I love that line. I don't shit rainbows.
But I, you know, it's just, you said conscious, just consciously moving through each day, voting with our words, voting with our dollars, and being mindful of what's happening around us. We need to live in a world that just slows down a bit and takes stock of everything. And, you know, if we're running the black sheep party, you know, which I think it would have to take a hell of a lot of black sheep to get this thing off the ground, I would probably go and I would consult with, you know, some indigenous elders and, you know, take some wisdom from that, you know. They had a lot of that figured out before we came here and stole everything and fucked everything up for those guys. So,
yeah, we've touched on that. And it's a beautiful thing about, you know, I've touched on this great story of Edmonton, right? And the gathering place, the Pehonen, that we were known for. And I think, wow, what was it like 5,000 years ago when we gathered here? And yeah, we had our skirmishes on the Battle River, you know, the Blackfoot, the Kainai Nation, and Tsitsika and the Cree. Yeah, we had our differences, but somehow we found a way of being in good relation with each other, of going, you know, enjoying the happy hunting ground, which is literally what this place was, you know. And Jared Diamond said, and I'm like, wow, what a spectacular story. I never heard that. Louis Saint-Laurent Catholic High School at the U of A after 3 degrees, never heard that story. I'm like, what a compelling story. that we use seashells and protocols of good relationships, and we didn't have business ethics or.
And now we live in a world where Ted Turner owns the largest herd of buffalo on the planet.
Like, yeah, like,
what's wrong with, like, that?
What do you mean owned? You
know, which is a sacred critter, right? Like, this is sacred for the people that we came and we displaced. So again, yeah. Podcast number 3, man, we can just go on forever.
We can go on. Well, thank you.
I got a question for you. This is a question that I love.
Over or whatever. This is not allowed on my sponsor. Doesn't allow questions.
No, you invite. It has to be dialogue. It's not just me spouting off my own zany. this is a big one, but what type of world is waiting for us after the pandemic? You touched on the opportunity. You know, I call it the invitation to create a new world. Like, we're in this, like, everybody's just sick of this. We want to just break free from this sort of imposed bondage, regardless of whether what your views are on everything. You know, is it, you know, life going back to normal? Is that even possible? Like, what is normal? You know, I used to handle normal is broken all the time. You know, or do we even want to go back to what it was before the pandemic? So, like, I'm really, you know, maybe selfishly crop seeding, you know, like a farmer putting some seeds and like, are you sure you want to go back to that bullshit we had before? You know, because, you know, maybe in the fall, it'll be some version of that. So what do you think?
Well, I am writing a fourth book. Well, it's writing itself. It's called, it'll either be called The Economics of Love or The Handbook for Building a Civilization of Love. In my first book, I end with that quote from Pope John Paul II, is, let us build a civilization of love, he said to the Czech ambassador in 2003. What the hell? The word civilization is a big word. So, but I believe inherently, when in May of last year, I just decided to test the idea of love in the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Declaration of Independence, a very high conscious document, by the way, and the great Charter of Freedom, the Magna Carta, which was so important to England, right, to contain King John. And the lords were upset. John, you can't be the Jeff Bezos of the world. We're going to contain you, and you're going to sign your name here, and you're going to share wealth with us. And I'm like, what the hell is a new Magna Carta of today that defines the fact that we are all loving creatures of the divine, here to, you know, find our own voice, here to be the love that we were supposed to be? That is what, you know, you could see the energy in me is like, that is compelling. That is beyond Harry Potter, Luke Skywalker. That isn't the force. That is the power, the French word, the power to be able to love. That is what we're capable of as human beings. why are we stuck in this funk? This, oh my God, it's so hard. Like, I can't travel anymore. It's like, wake up, grow up, understand that we all have this innate power of love. Everyone is equal and one in being with that love. How does that operate? I don't know. I don't have a clue how it operates, but it's sure the hell better than this ridiculous scarcity model where money is the only measure of success. No, I reject it completely. But I won't attack the enemy. I mean, I understand the enemy may be sociopaths who are very good. They have no empathy. I get it. But there's 7 billion of us who do have compassion, who do love our children, who are reminded by our 5-year-old or 7-year-old or 16-year-old that we have so much to look forward to. We have an eternity of love to look forward to. Yeah, we're in the shell for a little while, and then we'll throw it off, and who knows where we'll go. Nobody came back and said, Mark, it's awesome out there. Don't worry. Don't worry about death. What are we afraid of? We're afraid of a virus that'll kill us. Are we so afraid? Are we so afraid, as Jesus said, commanding with love? He said, you could tell the mountain to jump into the sea, and we do nothing about that proposition. So this is my vision. It's like, let us at least through these kind of, I think Jordan Peterson is right. It's through these kind of conversations that we enliven the 5-year-old Dennis, the 7-year-old Mark, you know, to play again, to play in this paradise that's right in front of us, and not be captured by a low conscious vibration called fear. There's nothing stopping us. Anything's possible. And you could talk about 3-dimensional, 5-dimensional phasing in and out, you know, fighting the Bill Gates of the world. No, no, let's transmute that, whatever that is. It's an errant gene. It's a, right? It's just, it's incongruent with love. So the only strategy has to be the use of transmutation of love with love of whatever we call evil, which is just love spelled backwards. That's my vision of the world. This is the first time you've heard it. My sponsor is going to deplatform me now.
Oh man, this is like that moment in your kitchen where you, what you're going to do on the fridge. I said, I'm not committing to anything this time.
But thanks for asking that. You know, I've got young people who are listening to this show. This young fellow yesterday, he said, oh, Mark, but he texted me yesterday, and which is kind of weird, right? So a 19-year-old, and he says, Mark, what do you think about this new announcement that they figured a way of combining a monkey gene with a human gene in the same kind of, I mean, just looks like the coronavirus, this nice blue orb thing. That's probably an embryo. I'm like, what are we doing? Like, what you think that's cool? Do you think that's playing God? Do you think that's, what is that? Is that just human pride and arrogance?
I would say that on the surface, it's demonstrating our lack of respect for the ethics in science. You know, we got so much technology and so much firepower. You know, we got the 3 richest people on the planet in a space race to try and gobble up outer space, you know, trying to leave this planet. Oh God, if we took all that money, energy, and just focused on fixing it, I know we can. You say all the time, if everybody on the planet just prayed on it, it would heal. We would create that healing. We would transmutate what the state that we're in. My words are a little bit different, but I do agree that even just thinking about life on Mars discards this thing that we're so intimately connected to. You know, we're so much more than we think we are. Like, I know, I know you're a religious man, and you, I know I've touched the edges of like those experiences through psychedelics and yoga and some pretty crazy breathing techniques. But so you know, just, we're just energy. What's the proposition? Lay it down.
So here's an interesting proposition. We've all heard of Atlantis, but what happened? We heard about the flood, Noah, right? What if, and we now have, there's evidence now, they found this ancient city in very close to Mount Ararat, which is where Noah's Ark supposedly landed after the Great Deluge. And how many years ago? Oh, well, they've now seeing that this ancient city in Turkey, they've discovered just 2 years ago. They think it was destroyed by the flood. And the flood maybe was 13,000 years ago. And so why did God bring the flood? Well, maybe we're getting a bit arrogant. Maybe Atlantis, with all its incredible artificial intelligence, all of its technology that it was so enamored with, had forgotten about one important technology, original human technology called love, which the Lemurians had. Lemurians are the ancient people of Turtle Island and Polynesia, the Pacifica. So what if we're at the 13,000 year time mark again? So drunk on technology. Wow, look how amazing things we've done in the last 50 years. We have these things. We have like unbelievable technology. But the original technology of love, we've parked in the closet. We told our kid when they were five, oh, don't, you know, your son's question, right? And to me, that's a fascinating proposition, that maybe we're at the same juncture that we were 13,000 years ago. And people still go, how did they build the pyramids? We don't even understand. Maybe they were levitating stones. Maybe they had that technology. And we still don't know. But we have this opportunity right now as a tipping point, maybe. And so I guess that's my closing reflection. And I've never had this reflection on this podcast. So you've now taken me down the rabbit hole. But it's something I think these are the conversations that are not happening on YouTube, in my opinion. Or there's a shriller voice on YouTube about an angry voice, like feeling
I mean, to hit that one with absolutes, I think might be a little bit harsh. I think they might be happening, but they gotta happen like Switzerland, right? The sort of like, oh, you know. Yeah. I'm right, you're wrong. It's sort of, hey, we gotta figure this out. Or if we don't, that's also okay, but it's over. You know, at the end of the world, and end of the day, sorry, the end of the world, there's a, at the end of the day, the earth doesn't need us on here. You know, it'll just keep on keeping on till it gets smashed up by an asteroid or something, or the sun explodes, I don't know. But We're not supposed to know how it all works. There's so many things that we just know we'll never know, and that's okay. But we do know that, you know, we're on our way to destination fucked right now. Or
Armageddon. I'm going to delete that French word from the, no, just kidding. No, it's true.
Armageddon, whatever, but we're more than we can even imagine. So Lemuria, you know, Atlantis, Easter Island, those are all really good, I guess, thought experiments, and I love that proposition. But if we fail to actualize and realize how much bigger we are than we're actually playing, then it doesn't matter. We're in the prison bars of our own self-doubt. You know, Instagram, you know, that's a fucking prison. I mean, that sounds a little bit righteous, but I think that's...
I'm gonna close off our conversation with this reflection. You know, yes, we both challenged each other in whatever year it was, whatever month it was, 2017. And wow. I finished my second book and you haven't finished your Morrow Men yet, but it's gonna be out. And I often reflect on my first book, which was published in 2007. And it was my students at Bainbridge Graduate Institute, the first MBA in sustainability in the Bainbridge Island across from Seattle, where Chief Seattle was from. That's where he lived. And I'll never forget meeting those students. And they said, Mark, you got to write this down. You're freaking us out. You've blown our minds open. We didn't understand anything about money and the matrix. And I would use the matrix as my teaching metaphor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that moment of then actually meeting my publisher in San Francisco, and it was impossible to get a book published, almost impossible, nonfiction in Canada. And somehow this little publisher from Gabrielle Island happens to be at this conference called the Lohas, like, you know, super like San Francisco, right? 35,000 people coming through, and people like us get to stand up and talk about our, you know, whatever ideas. Deepak Chopra was there, you know, Lynn Twist, Soul of Money author, you know, all these famous people, and me, right? So I get to talk about my idea. My book publisher is there. I said, come and listen to me. So, you know, not expecting him to sign any contract. And the next day we signed the contract because they were so compelled about what I was presenting. Then I got the contract, had 3 months to finish the manuscript, and I couldn't write. I was like, I don't want to write this book. Even if my students are so compelling, no, can't write it. You know, and in that moment, I got an email from out of the blue from someone in New York. Actually, I didn't even know where she was from. And she said, I was sitting under a tree this morning and I heard this voice, and go home and Google the true meaning of wealth. And I found your website. Thank you, Judy. I was like, what? Who? What? This person knows, has a sense of what, why I'm writing this book, right? And then she became kind of my teacher during that next few months where I finished the manuscript. And it was hard because I had to just trust my business chapter. I remember writing at the Sugar Bowl. It took me 2 days to write that thing because it just came out. I mean, I could have written lots of things about sustainability. And she said something, this is what I'll end with. She said, you know, something, Mark, says the Atlanteans have come back and they're saying, don't forget what we forgot. I said, what do they say? It's like, we forgot about love. I was like, note to self, note to the planet, note to the world leaders. And try to unpack that rabbit hole.
No, man. We're just going to end there.
And to infinity and beyond, back to the future. Chapter amazing. 80 in the ongoing series of amazing conversations.
So good to chat with you, my friend.
Thanks so much. Having.